Good morning, everybody. Glad that everybody made it out. I know we had a lot of rain this week, to say the least. It seemed like it rained every day. I wanted to kind of just real quick, I'm not going to go back through everything we talked about last week, but just for those of you who weren't here, what we're talking about is we're doing a little three-week study on the Bible, the history of it. Last week we talked about its composition, its makeup, where how it was put together. This week we're going to go more into its history and translation. So there will be a lot of dates. So if you like dates, you might enjoy this one. If not, I encourage you to please stay around next week, because next week we will be getting into a lot of the staying power and the living book that it is, and talking about the Bible and why it is so important in our lives and throughout the history of the world. And we're going to get into some of that today, but I really wanted to talk through some of the translation history of the Bible as well. It's the most translated book in history. I'm sure that's not a surprise. A couple little quick videos here, one on the history of the Bible translation, again using the Bible Project, which we talked a little bit about last week, and then one on choosing a Bible translation and things of that sort, and then we will talk a little bit about that. So hopefully this will work. It worked earlier. If it's too loud, let me know.
The Hebrew Bible is a collection of scrolls written and assembled over a 1,000-year period by the Israelites, written in Hebrew. The first significant translation was done in Greek. It was called the Septuagint, and this translation was widely used among followers of Jesus. Jesus claimed that the story of the Hebrew Bible was coming to its fulfillment through him, and his followers wrote about this claim in a new collection of writings called the New Testament. They were written in Greek. These two collections became the sacred writings of Christianity, the Bible. There have been many translations of the Bible over time, and here are three important ones. The Latin Vulgate was created for the Catholic Church. The Wycliffe Bible first brought the Bible into popular English, and the King James Bible was created as the official Bible of the Church of England. The entire Bible is now translated into over 700 languages. The New Testament by itself has been translated into an additional 1,500 languages. This all makes the Bible the most translated literary work in human history.
Now, I'm sure there's nothing there that was really a surprise to you.
Other than the 2,300 languages?
Yeah, well, that's a lot. But the Bible as we know it, and one of the things that we're talking about in this study is, you know, as kids, I grew up in the Church of Christ. I grew up in the local church here in Nashville, Tennessee. And we learn a lot of things about the books of the Bible and the stories in the Bible and the story of Jesus. We don't spend a lot of time on how all that was put together in history and to get to where we are today. So that's kind of where we laid the groundwork last week. We're going to do more of that this week. Before we get to this next video, the different translations of the Bible. I bet we have multiple versions just within this room. So If you have a particular version that you enjoy reading, just kind of raise your hand and let's kind of see how many just we have in here.
New Living Translation.
Okay, New Living Translation.
NIV.
Okay, NIV.
New King James.
Okay.
New Century.
New Century. Any others? Okay, well, there are multiple different versions, and this next video talks about the different versions and how, you know, they're interpreted and things of that sort. Again, it's real short, but just take a quick look at this and then we will get on with some other.
There are many translations of the Bible, so which one should you read? In short, read as many as you can, because no one does everything, because they're designed for different purposes, and using many translations will give you a well-rounded understanding. Every translation is balancing two goals. First is faithfulness to the wording of the original language, and the second is readability in normal English. Place these on a spectrum, and you get word-for-word translations up here and thought-for-thought translations down here. Word-for-word translations try to imitate the original language and so require you, the reader, to do more interpretive work yourself. Thought-for-thought translations do more interpretive work for you by paraphrasing what they think the text means, and most translations are somewhere in the middle. Now, keep in mind that no Bible translation can perfectly represent what's in the original language because no two languages are identical. So pay attention to when translations differ and try to read as many Bible translations as you can.
So, with that piece of information, this is a little chart that kind of throws out some of the translations that we have on that spectrum. From one end, you've got New American Standard. On the other end, you have the Message. I don't think that there's any on here that anybody hasn't heard of before. But as the video was talking about the translations of the Bible, and we talked about some of this last week in the way that the Old Testament was continued to be written throughout time, and how the New Testament, you had the Tanakh and the Hebrew, and then you had the Greek. We talked through some of that. This is a little loud, let me know. But this being the translations, these are the different ways to read through the scriptures, like the video was talking about, basically trying to be more word for word to the original text, to more of a paraphrase that is more in common language that we would use today. So another thing that the video didn't talk about, though, is there are different types of Bibles that use the translations. For instance, you had the Daily Study Bible. I have one here that I really enjoy because I like the history, but the Chronological Study Bible that compares history to the scriptures and kind of lays them out in chronological time, it's really, really good. You've got other ones like the Children's Bible. You know, you read stories to the children as kids and things like that. So if you really think about it, there are just so many different ways to read the message that's in the Bible, to interpret the message that's in the Bible. And as we said last week, I think that's something as Christians that's very important to us, is that we spend time researching and spending time in them ourselves, just like the Bereans did back in the early church. So, how did we get the actual printed version of the Bible? Some of you may know about this, some of you may not, but anybody know about the Gutenberg printing press? Okay, it changed the world, and we're going to see a little bit of a video on that too. But it changed the world in the aspect of we've all grown up in a timeline where you could just go to a bookstore and buy a book or buy a Bible, or even now on your phone, you have quick access to it. Well, that didn't happen until almost 1,500 plus years after Christ. So you had a long period of time where there were not printed copies of the Bible that were available to everybody. It was very expensive and time-consuming to do the handwritten versions. Anyway, this will talk through some of that, but I thought that it would be useful to this discussion.
Movable metal typeset printing is one of the greatest inventions of the last millennium. It revolutionized the way people created and produced books. But what exactly is movable typeset, and why was it such a big deal? Before the movable type printing press was invented, books were expensive and either copied by hand or made using block printing. Copying books by hand was tedious and time-consuming, and scribes sometimes made copying errors. Block printing meant that text and images had to be carved into blocks of wood, then covered with ink and stamped onto a page. These blocks were time-consuming to create and use. By 1450, less than 30,000 books existed in all of Europe. All of this would change with the innovations of Johannes Gutenberg. In the late 1390s, Johannes Gutenberg was born into an upper-class family in Mainz, Germany. He learned various crafts like blacksmithing, jewel cutting, and goldsmithing. Around 1450, he began developing new techniques for improving the printing press. Gutenberg created a process using movable metal type, which meant that letters could be rearranged into countless patterns. This was faster and more accurate than any previous method. It made books and tracts much more affordable. first major project was printing the Bible in Latin. By 1500, there were over 200 printing shops in Europe. It is estimated that between 8 and 20 million books were printed during those first 50 years. This type of printing press would lead to the mass production of the Bible. This meant that the Bible was more accessible and affordable to people than ever before. The effects of Gutenberg's invention were enormous. Ideas spread across Europe and the world faster than they ever had. This contributed to major cultural and intellectual movements such as the Renaissance, the Reformation, the Scientific Revolution, and the Enlightenment. Printed books, including the Bible, were more affordable for everyone. Gutenberg's innovations revolutionized the process of book production and the way people engaged with the Bible.
So, I don't know if you noticed in there the wooden block ink transfer. It was early scrapbookers of the day, if you ever want to go back to where scrapbooking first came from. So that, but you could see, again, it was really hard for just your common person to own a copy of the Bible or any book. And you can see the impact that just this one press had on the explosion of the availability of literature and resource. It's hard to tell the story of the Bible without talking about the printing press, because it changed the ability to both, like I said, get it into people's hands, but it also changed how some of the churches of the day dealt with the Bible and translations to the common people. We'll talk about that here in a little bit. All right, so we're going to get into some of these dates. I'm going to be going really quickly through some of this because it's kind of hard to tell thousands of years story in about 30 minutes, but we're going to go through some of this, and then we're going to get into its impact, the Bible's impact on the world as well. So the Old Testament era, from creation to BC 2000, the earliest scriptures were handed down orally from generation to generation. There really was no other form of, again, no mass producing, no, you know, anything of that sort. So there's stories you talk about, you know, the Bible talks about writing everything on your doorways and, you know, things of that sort. So there were lots of memorization and sharing that went on during that time. Now, this next one, the book of Job, perhaps the oldest book of the Bible, was written. Now, keep in mind that the stories didn't happen. You know, Job wasn't the first, obviously, the first story of the Bible. Genesis and the creation was. But the actual first book of the Bible that was written seems to be Job, back in the 2000 to 1500 BC realm. Now, the Ten Commandments are given to Moses in 1500 to 1400 BC, recorded on stone tablets and put in the Ark of the Covenant. This is one of those things that, in my mind, when you get to heaven and you can kind of see the history of time on DVR or on record or whatever, I want to go see this event. I want to see the tablets and the creation of the Ten Commandments with how that translated. And, you know, it would just have been an incredible experience to see. But that's the timeline that happened in. Now, we talked about this last week, that it wasn't until about 300 years before Christ that all 39 books of the Old Testament had been written, collected, and recognized as an official Jewish Bible. So you can see a lot of time, a lot of what is recorded in the Bible has happened in a long period of time to now have it documented and all recognized together. You know, this is one that, unless you are a Bible history buff, you wouldn't realize. You've probably heard of the Septuagint. We talked about this some last week, being the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible as at that time. But you would not really have connected that this Septuagint Bible existed at the time that Jesus was doing his ministry, that this was the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible at the time. It existed, and we talked about the books of the Apocrypha as well as some of the other, pardon me if I don't say this right, pseudepigraphia books of the time. We went into that in depth last week as well, so I won't rehash it, but it was all recorded. You do have the opportunity to go listen to that. So,
but now, were the 14 books of the Apocrypha in the Septuagint?
Yes. Yes, they existed at Jesus' time and were there. And we talked a little bit about last week about he never referenced them, nor did anybody else. So, again, I think that piece of the story is important to the history of the Bible, and we'll get more into that today. But, you know, even all the way up until the original New King James Version had the books of the Apocrypha as a section at the end. So, anyway... New Testament era, about 45 to 100 years after Jesus was when all the 27 books of the Greek New Testament had been written. There was, and we talked about this some last week, there was some other writings that were going on at the time that even Paul referenced in one of his letters that talked about some false teachings and how to recognize letters from him. We went into that last week, but it kind of created a need to establish a New Testament canon. In AD 312, the Codex Vaticanus, possibly among one of the first 50 copies of the Bible, was ordered by Emperor Constantine and eventually kept in the Vatican Library in Rome. Again, knowing this is all, and I know this is not something that we regularly get into, but understanding history, you know, whether it be emperors or governors or whatever you want to, kings, and then the stories of the Bible that we read, they all are happening at the same time, and we don't always do a good job of putting those together to see how these things happen and fit together. AD 367, Anastasius of Alexandria identified the complete New Testament canon, 27 books, for the first time. That was when we talked about the Old Testament piece a little bit earlier. This is the New Testament piece. We talked about St. Jerome translates the New Testament from Greek to Latin, and it becomes part of the Latin Vulgate. We talked about he included the Apocrypha along with that, although he didn't believe that they were inspired books, but he did include them because they were historical documents that were referenced at the time. Now, it wasn't until AD 397 that the Third Synod of Carthage, and we could get really boring and deep into going into all these different, things. So I'm kind of shortening this list down. There's tons and tons and tons of things happening in between all these dates, but I'm trying to hit some of the highlights of them. But this was when the New Testament canon was actually approved. Then in AD 390, 405 or so, St. Jerome did the Old Testament from Hebrew to Latin and completed the Latin Vulgate that was talked about in the video, which was all 39 Old Testament books, the 27 New Testament books, and 14 of the Apocrypha books. Now, we also talked about last week that there were a whole bunch of those other writings that were not included in this as well, and we went through a website and scrolled through, and I showed you all the different things that are out there, but these were the 14 that they settled on, that the Catholic Church had settled on.
Brandon?
Yes.
Who are St. Jerome and that other, authority?
Excuse me, and I'm not a major history buff, but my understanding is they were related to the Catholic Church. They were part of, either bishops or priests at the time that had high recognition in the church, and they were, commissioned to do these works, but they did these on behalf of the church. Now, for the next 500-600 years, it's just continually translated into multiple different languages, but it is not a book of the people, and that's important to the story. We've talked about this in one of the previous times I was in here when we were talking about chapter and verses. It wasn't until 1,200 years after Christ that Stephen Langdon, who later would become the Archbishop of Canterbury, created the first chapter and verse divisions for the Bible. In 1229, the Council of, and I don't know if it's this Tolos or Tolus, forbids and prohibits people from owning a Bible. You know, these are things that we don't always study or know about, but again, this was a, it kind of went back to the church felt like only priests could read and translate the Bible the way that it should be told to the common people, that if it was allowed to be in the hands of the common person, that they would form their own opinions and, you know, maybe challenge the way that they were doing things. Yes.
Oh, I get to use the microphone. Thank you. I've always looked at it from the teacher's standpoint, this little, the concept of the way the church handled it, it was like they didn't want the common person to have the answer key. If that makes any sense to all of you former students.
Do you want to get ahead of the lesson?
Oh, am I getting ahead by doing that?
Possibly, yes. But, no, carry on. I mean, it's a good point.
Answer key.
Okay. Yes, it was... We're afraid. It was out of fear, basically. They didn't know where it was gonna lead. So we don't want you to. We want to tell you not.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep. So as part of that, in AD 1381 to 1382, John Wycliffe and some friends, associates, in defiance of the church, believing that the people should be permitted to read the Bible in their own language, began to translate and produce the first manuscripts in English. And they included the 39 Old Testament, the 27 New Testament, and the Apocrypha books. But this is really a outright defiance moment. And they were persecuted as a result of it. In fact, after Wycliffe died of cancer, I believe, Pope Martin exhumed his bones and burned them to ashes. I guess that was a little vengeance on... I can't really fathom that, but that's what he did. I mean, they were so upset that this was happening in the church that they were publicly out to show it. So, AD 1455, we talked about the printing press, Gutenberg's Bible. They printed it in the Latin Vulgate and really changed the course of history, like some major things that have happened, you know, the internet, or, I mean, just major moments in time. The printing press, as it talked about, just really ramped forward the ability for the common person to have a book. So it kind of started, yes?
I wonder if Gutenberg, oh, thank you very much. Hey, I wonder if Gutenberg was just chasing the almighty dollar by printing that many Bibles, or was he a believer?
That's a good question. That's one thing
Mark
we
Hayes.
Could...
Mark Hayes might know.
He would know.
I don't know.
A very good question. But obviously the fact that he spent so much time printing the Bible probably would lead me to believe that he was. So in 1522, Martin Luther translated and produced the New Testament for the first time in German, again, including those additional books that we talked about before. In 1525, William Tyndale produced the first translation of the New Testament from Greek into English, and you would think that he would be rewarded for this work. So, we're going to talk what happens to him in just a minute. Miles Coverdale finishes Tyndale's work in 1535, producing the first completed printed Bible in English, including the same books as before. However, the Roman Catholic Church did not like it. So they tied Tyndale to a stake, strangled him to death, and then burned him for his gift to the people. You know, it's hard to really think through that. You know, we talk about having differences in opinion with different denomination or churches or whatever, but, you know, this was a time when just putting the Bible into a language that people could understand was causing the death of others. So, the Roman Catholic Council of Trent declared the Latin Vulgate as the exclusive Latin authority for the Bible. Again, trying to kind of circle this back in, the Bible should be read and taught in Latin, and this is our official decree as a result of that. In 1560, the Geneva Bible was printed in Switzerland, the first English version to include chapters and verses, and became the Bible of the Protestant Reformation. In 1582, the Catholic Church drops its Latin-only policy and produces its first English Catholic Bible, the Reims New Testament, from the Latin Vulgate. So you can see times are changing their methodology through it. 1611, the King James Version, also called the Authorized Version, is released, and it's said to be the most printed book in the history of the world. And as we mentioned last week, it did include the Apocrypha as an appendix. It wasn't until 1885 that they dropped it. So the next group, and I know I'm going quick, so if you have any questions, feel free to stop me. There's just a lot of boring timeline that you want to get through, but it's all important to the history of where we've gone. So your first little pocket-sized Bible was produced in 1790. 1791, the first family Bible of the King James is produced in America. In this one, Isaiah Thomas, not the basketball player, but produced the first illustrated version of the King James Version in America. In 1808, Jane Aiken was the first woman to print a Bible. 1833, we know this name well, Noah Webster. He published his dictionary, and then he released his own revised version of the King James Version. Something I did not know as I was going through this, but very interesting. Then again in 1881, 1885, the King James Bible is revised and published as a revised version in England. A few years later, you have the American Standard Version, the Revised Standard Version, as we're getting close to more common times. And then in late 40s, early 50s, the Dead Sea Scrolls. We talked about that a good bit last week, being a pretty significant find because it showed that the scriptures that we were using at the time matched up with almost exactly to the scriptures from way back when. The New American Standard came out in 1971. How many of you have heard of the Silver Scrolls? Believed to be the oldest Bible text ever, were discovered in Old Jerusalem. Now, some interesting things about this. There were two amulets found in a burial cave west of Jerusalem, and they were dated to be centuries older than the Dead Sea Scrolls. Some people have put them around 7th century B.C. Some people have put them around 6th century B.C., but really, really old scrolls. And they proved that at least some of the Old Testament scriptures had been written close to the time that the events actually happened. And that's pretty significant because we talked last week some about how the New Testament was put together, and one of the qualifications they had for those books was that they had to be written or written by an eyewitness or by someone who was closely associated with an eyewitness or with Jesus. So being able to verify that writings of the time matched up with some of the actual events, even centuries before, is very important. Now, there were two verses engraved on the amulets. No, they did not say number 6, 24 to 26, because they didn't have those, obviously, chapter and verse. But if somebody would like to read number 6, 24 through 26, I think you will recognize and the wording that was on the scroll. So it's pretty impressive.
Someone raise your hand. You got it over there?
Yeah.
All right.
The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace.
So, here is an actual artifact that was found in the 80s that goes all the way back to a timeline when those scripture was being passed down orally. Now, this stuff was chiseled, you know, written. It was if you go and you study these, and we won't, again, much more time could be spent on things like this, but it is important. So I encourage you to go read about some of these. But there were things to read and some pieces missing, but they were almost word for word, the written words lining up with the scripture. There was also Deuteronomy 7:9, if somebody has that.
Know therefore that the Lord your God is God. He is the faithful God, keeping his covenant of love to 1,000 generations of those who love him and keep his commandments.
So pretty powerful things to find that were actually created all the way back there, and it matches up with scriptures we read today, thousands of years later. In 1996, the New Living Translation was published, and in 2001, the English Standard Version was published. So you can just see time after time after time different things that are rolling out that are important as we think through the actual creation, the stories, the things that are documented in the Bible all the way through to where we are today, and the things that we read and study about. So, any questions, thoughts on that before I kind of shift gears a little bit? I know that was a lot. And this is on a PowerPoint PDF that will be available at the end of all this. If anybody's interested, I can send it to them so you don't have to worry about scrambling and writing all this stuff down.
We started looking really early in the 300s, and so, and then we get to the 1300s, 1400s, 1500s, where there's a lot of controversy about the written Bible and putting it in English and everything. Mm-hmm. Well, there was a lot of disagreement early on about what should be in those 27 mm-hmm. books in the New Testament and all, and there were groups like down in Egypt specifically that were wanting other more recent scriptures put in there that mm-hmm. were labeled heretic by this. But the councils, I guess the Council of Nicaea that came out with the Nicene mm-hmm. Creed at the same time, they were labeling other groups that were inventing stuff on their own or more recent things that they wanted in the Bible heretic. And even then, they were persecuting people that didn't, you know, agree with the official line of thought there. And it took a long time and a lot of controversy to get those, you know, first 27 books mm-hmm. of the New Testament in there. There was a lot of disagreement, and even the emperor gets involved, and Constantine gets involved in some of this, and labels mm-hmm. different groups and sects heretics. So it's a lot of controversy for hundreds of years there.
Oh yeah, and you think they're just a few hundred years from the actual life of Jesus, and here we are thousands of years later, and we still disagree about stuff with people.
No, we don't.
Well, we don't like to admit it. But the Bible and its impact on the world, as we go through this, we mentioned on the video, translated 717 languages. Portions of the New Testament have been translated into over 2,000 languages. The Guinness Book of World Records has said that some 2.5 billion copies were printed from 1815 to 1975, although they claim by now it's closer to 5 billion printed copies. In 2017... some 20 million Bibles were purchased annually in the United States, with about 92% of all Americans possessing one or more copies. The average Christian had 9 in their home at that time. I don't know how many you have in your house now, but I can think of quite a few. So it's fair to say that over 100 million copies are sold around the world annually. It's also the most stolen and banned book of all time. Bound and printed copies still sell, but now there's 24 million Bible apps that became available between January and June of 2020. I can't imagine what was going on during that timeline. And online searches for Bible keywords have now reached a five-year record. just some quotes. Influence of the Bible being worldwide. Its mighty power has affected every department of human activity. The contents of the scriptures have supplied themes for greatest poets, artists, musicians, which the world has yet has produced, and have been the mightiest factor of all in shaping the moral progress of the race. The existence of the Bible as a book for the people is the greatest benefit which the human race has ever experienced. Every attempt to belittle it is a crime against humanity, from an 18th century philosopher. It's the most quoted piece of literature in history and has more influence on the language, culture, and laws than any other book or idea ever published. This was really interesting. David Crystal wrote a book named Begat, the King James Bible in the English language, which he counts 257 phrases from the King James Bible that are in our contemporary English vernacular. Some of them gave up the ghost, out of the mouth of babes, put words in my mouth, feet of clay, salt of the earth, fought the good fight, turned the world upside down, God forbid, take root, the powers that be, filthy rich, no peace for the wicked, a fly in the ointment, the blind leading the blind. So that's just a few, there's just a few of those, but we people who don't even really recognize that as coming from Scripture are saying lots of things that have that came from that. So its impact on the world as far as on American literature, here's just a few of some of the major writings. There's tons and tons. We could, again, you could spend hours and hours just going through that, but I didn't recognize that in Uncle Tom's Cabin there were over 100 quotation and direct references from the Bible. But we've read all these books. We have studied all these books, but they have biblical themes woven throughout them. Its impact on film. Any films come to mind?
Oh, Moses.
Obviously. Well, here's several, and you may say, wow, well, why The Lord of the Rings or Chronicles of Narnia or things like that? Well, they were deeply rooted in the Christian philosophy and mindset. C.S. Lewis and J.R. Tolkien, you can go read some of their other writings that are Christian in nature as well.
Star Wars.
Yes. In fact, I'll have a reference to that later. I can't help myself. But, you know, even things to today like The Chosen TV series. I mean, these are all things that are deeply rooted in the Bible. Its impact on the world in art. You know, I was just over in Rome, and I got to take a tour of the Vatican, and unbelievable. Just unbelievable, the art, the scope, the intricacy, the time that was taken into all these things. And you wouldn't do any of that unless you were very passionate about what you were trying to, you know, put paint to ink to writing to, just incredible things. And I've also had the privilege to go to the Louvre, and there's lots of, again, just tons and tons of our earthly history ties directly back to the Bible and the story of Jesus. I did not know that the Metropolitan Museum in New York gave tours just on biblical art. Didn't know that. This were just some pictures of some famous churches around the world. You may or may not know all of them. I'm not going to list all of them, but some of them you could easily recognize. The Cathedral of Notre Dame, St. Peter's Basilica, Westminster Abbey is in there, but just massive architecture structures that are there as a result of the story of the Bible.
Right.
Yeah.
A lot of those buildings you were seeing, when you study how long it took to not only paint the inside of those, but to build them, and you start figuring it out, if you were a person of those days that was incredibly talented that could do that, chances are you're going to spend your whole life working on it. It was never finished. You died, handed it over to somebody else, to continue to do the exact same thing. And, you know, I mean, the same things with the Great Wall of China or whatever. But when you study the length, you know, these things, nowadays we can put structures up and, I mean, look at our own city. Look how quick Nashville's just, the whole landscape's changing. I mean, that stuff took 100 and so many years to build. And it's just, it's crazy, and all we do is just look. You know, we go on trips. We got a mindset of Nashville, Tennessee.
Yep. The Bible has had a major impact on laws and morality. You know, you can see the two commandments summing up the law of God. We all have read and studied, loving thy neighbor as thyself, and loving the Lord thy God with all the heart, the mind, the soul. All these things are woven throughout history of time as well. But as far as just with some of our presidents, it's pretty impressive to see what some of our older presidents have said. I've always said, I will always say that the studious perusal of the sacred volume will make better citizens, better fathers, and better husbands. Thomas Jefferson. John Quincy Adams said, so great is my veneration for the Bible that the earlier my children begin to read it, the more confident we'll be in the hopes that they will prove useful citizens to their country and respectable members of society. Abraham Lincoln, it's the duty of nations as well as men to recognize the truth announced in the Holy Scripture and proven by all history that those nations only are blessed whose God is the Lord. Ronald Reagan said, inside the Bible's pages lie the answers to all the problems that mankind has even known. I hope that Americans will read and study the Bible. Theodore Roosevelt said, the thorough knowledge of the Bible is worth more than a college education. So again, all kinds of just statements we don't hear today, but are major factors in our history. In fact, the founding fathers went on to acknowledge God no less than four times in the Declaration of Independence. The laws and nature of nature, God, all men are created equal. They're endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, appealing to the supreme judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions, with firm reliance on the protection of the divine providence, again, woven through even the early fabric of our own country. We know the Ten Commandments. This was an interesting thing. It was an article from the Family Research Council that quoted a USA Today poll that said 60% of Americans cannot name five of the Ten Commandments. 74% can name all three of the Three Stooges, though. 35% can recall the six kids' names from the Brady Bunch. 25% can name all the ingredients of the Big Mac. But only 14% can accurately name all Ten Commandments. Yet, 78% are in favor of the public display of them, but they don't know what they are. So, the greatest tragedy is not that the Ten Commandments are vanishing from public schools, courtrooms, and government buildings, it's that they are disappearing from the minds, hearts, and the lives of most Americans. So, quickly going through this, as I know we're just about out of time, but we're seeing, I'll call it a decline in the world, but it's not the end of the story. And we're going to get into that next week. The power of the Bible is not declining. It's society's use of that is declining. So this was the percentage of people with a biblical worldview has declined in each generation over the last four generations. And a biblical worldview is defined as a world which seeks to answer life's biggest questions from the teachings of the Bible. This was an article that said that during COVID, 50% of Americans said that, 26 million Americans stopped reading the Bible regularly during COVID. And in 2021, only 50% said that they read the Bible on their own at least three or four times a year. Now, in 2022, only 39% say that they read the Bible more than three times a year. It's the steepest decline on record. So I'm not going to be able to get into this. This was an interesting story. Maybe I can wrap it into next week. But it was a chapel talk that happened when I was in college. But I really wanted to hit this last piece, before we're done. So culture has crept into religion across time and history. And if you think about from the time the scriptures were written, and the time Jesus was here, until all the way through today, you can think of some some examples of this. In the Jewish times, they hammered on the legalism of the law. They hammered on that. Legalism crept itself into religion during those times. In the early first century church, they had discussions of tradition and exclusion over Jews and Gentiles and who was required to do what and not do what. And, you know, so the way they viewed their own genealogies played into how they dealt with others in the church. The Catholic Church, we talked about this earlier, it was a lot about the power of the church, that the common people were not allowed to leave the Bible, even killing people to stop its access. Now, I'm not saying that people in any, whether they're Jews or whether they're in any religion or denomination, it all has its root in Christ. So there are good people in all of this, but ultimately what we're talking about here is the church hierarchy itself wanting to restrict access. The Middle Ages, the Crusades, violence, the Spanish Inquisition. I mean, we're talking about just absolutely insane ways of you will be a Christian. You know, those kind of things. It's a dark time in the history. In the United States, democracy. The Lord's church is not a democracy. Yet we will continue to bring that into, well, let's all vote on it and see if we're good with that, and then we'll just accept that as the way it is. I mean, these are the ways of the day that are creeping into the way we view and read our scriptures. But, you know, Jesus is the head of the church. That's not a democracy. Yet, that's the world we live in. And then today you've got the age of acceptance, of tolerance, the cancel culture, all these things that bleed itself into the way we act and treat others. And that's why it's so important to read the Bible, to study the Bible, to lean on the Bible itself, because there's nothing in there that deals with all this. We bring that as humans. We bring that into the world. We bring that into and connect that to Scripture. So with that as the storyline, I told you I'd give you a Star Wars reference, so I have to end on that. I kind of view this as the second The Empire Strikes Back. Okay, this is the where we've gone in our history. There's lots of positives, but the decline of our nation and our world in biblical view is not where it has been in the past, even within our own country. But next week, we're going to get deeply into the staying power of the Bible, why it is a living book. We're going to talk about how it changes lives, how it will always endure. We will just talk about it being alive and what that means. So it will be a great way to wrap up the series. And I encourage you, if you have any questions, I know I talked a lot today. We went through a lot. But if you have any questions, feel free to ask me. But I hope that you'll come back next week and hear the end of this, because that's the most powerful piece to this story that we all need to understand. So thank you for your time. I know we went a little late.